Yes, the Extra Innings Podcast is back. Welcome. I'm Mariners beat writer Ryan Divish, back from a little hiatus in Montana for the weekend that saw the Mariners sweep the Royals and wear some interesting uniforms. This week's episode is just a typical one with Larry Stone and I talking a little bit about Mariners baseball, a few different things. Specifically, what we saw from the weekend with the Mariners, the uniforms from turn back to turn ahead the clock night. We also get into some All-Star stuff, the idea whether or not the All-Star game is physically taxing on a player versus going. Some trade stuff, who's the biggest threat for the Mariners in the second wild card. Basically, we just kind of ramble because that's what we do best. So Larry and I will have that conversation. First, I really want to thank the folks at the Seattle Times, my main sports editor, Paul Barrett, assistant sports editor now turned to general assignment writer, Scott Hansen, my co-worker, Adam Jude, my buddy, Todd Millis, who freelances. Those guys all helped in or allowed me to take this weekend off and go back to Montana to do this charity thing that I do every year. It's a softball tournament for a friend of mine who lost his daughter in a car wreck, and we raised some money for scholarships and just awareness about seatbelts and safety. And so we get to go back and play a little fast pitch softball and try and recapture my glory days back when I used to play a lot of fast pitch. And it's always fun, get to see my family, get some home cooked meals and just a little break. So I really appreciate them filling in for me. I really appreciate the Times for allowing me that time off to go and do that. It's something that's really important to me, and they were really cool about letting me do that. So I can't thank them enough. I did watch all three of the games while I was back in Montana. I DVR'd them, but I pretty much was able to watch most of them live. So I saw how well the Mariners played. I saw how bad the Royals are. That's something Larry and I discussed, just how bad some of these teams are, the Mariners playing, but how well they played to do that. I was really impressed with Marco Gonzalez and James Paxton and the size of Nelson Cruz's arms in those uniforms. So as for coming up, the Mariners have three games with the Angels, followed by the Rockies, and then back out on the road to face these teams again. So without further ado, or me rambling on without much of a point, let's get to Larry Stone. Welcome in Larry Stone, my favorite columnist, the Seattle Times. There's two of you, so it's a tough competition. Don't tell Matt. You feel better about that?
I do. I'm honored, and I won't tell number two.
Yeah.
I'll just call him number two from now on. Every time I see him.
Okay, Dr. Evil. What? Where are you doing? Where are you at?
I'm at the office working on a column for tomorrow, but I'm happy to take time away to talk about the Mariners and baseball. I know you're back from a weekend of playing fast pitch softball, and you even pitched, which I thought your pitching days were done because of your arm woes. But
I pitched an inning. The shoulder reconstruction held up. I'm still not supposed to, but I did it anyways. And I did it early in the morning game because my dad was sleeping in, and so he didn't see me. Because if he had saw me, he would have went on the field and drug me off the field by my ears, just like he did once when I was in Legion baseball.
And what did he say? What did he say when he found out?
Well, my mom was there, and she wasn't going to tell anybody, and nobody was really going to tell anybody. And then my buddy George, who you met at the Open, he narked me off on Saturday night when we were having pizzas and beers, and so I was not happy. My dad used a lot of expletives that we can't use on this podcast.
A lot of your personality is becoming clear the more I hear about
from my
dad.
Yes, very true. No, so I did was able, even though I. And big thanks. I'm sure I'll do it earlier, but thanks to everybody who helped me let me do this. I go every year to this charity softball tournament in Montana, but I was able to watch the Mariners play
the games. First of all, Larry, what did you think of the uniforms on Saturday night?
I actually went with my son and sat in the stands, and we got a kick out of them. I thought the whole thing was well done. I mean,
they always do a good job on that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, and what I tweeted that what makes it stand out is the little details. You know, not the big touches like the uniform, that's good, but just the little things like the out of town scoreboard with the you know, Pluto beating Neptune and that sort of thing, and the PA that's altered to sound like a robot's voice, and it's not a third baseman, it's sector 3 and that kind of thing. You know, it's all just very clever. I wasn't sure if I liked the uniforms that were not tucked in. Mm-hmm. I wish everything had been uniform, but the players were clearly having fun with it. And you know, for one day, who cares? You know, just enjoy it and soak it in. And if you didn't like them, they'll be back to the regular uniforms the next day.
You know what? If you didn't like those uniforms, you can argue with Nelson Cruz's arms over it. All right, that's ridiculous. I mean, you and I see him on a daily or semi-daily basis, so we know how big he is in person. But man, that really it made it. You know, he's standing in the box and he's got no sleeves on. It was pretty ridiculous.
It reminded me of and here's a chance for you to say that I'm skewing ancient.
Boop
Powell? No, older. Ted Kluszewski.
Oh yeah, the Clues. Yeah.
Back in the old days, the Redlegs used to wear occasionally sleeveless uniforms, and there's old pictures of Kluszewski with massive Nelson Cruz arms back in the 50s, and probably not so massive by today's standards, but back then he was a behemoth.
So did you write a column on that in the 50s complaining that they weren't the same uniforms as the 1919 World Series that you also covered as well? Or
I probably did. I'll have to go back in my archives and see if I can find one.
My dad, who is getting more like Clint Eastwood's character from Gran Torino every day, he didn't like the uniforms at all. But he didn't like the untucked part. He didn't like the sleeveless part. My mom was fascinated by Ben Gamel's tattoos.
But everyone sees it a little bit differently. The hat backwards, a few of them.
Yeah.
D. Gordon. I think Gordon, Gamel, and Spann. I believe were the ones that wore their hats backwards.
I mean, it's fine. It's one game. I mean, I don't think Abner Doubleday is rolling over in his grave. You know, it's one game. I thought it was cool. They did a good job with it, as always. I don't know what was going on with Goldsmith's hair that he was doing the gray in there, but
yeah, I ran into him in the. I actually went up into the press box before the game, and I ran into Goldsmith, and had to do a double take because there was like a streak of silver in there. And he goes, "Well, it's the future. I'm old now."
Yeah.
So that's you know, that's another touch. Just things like that that Kevin Martinez and Greg Green, the two marketing honchos. I don't know if there's anyone better at those kind of events than those two guys.
Yeah, they, like you said, they think of every last detail. And as I've realized, you know, they have a lot of power because, you know, they got me pretty good on my birthday the other day with the pit bull and the video. And then they turned it into a GIF and it was not good. So I've learned to not make fun of those guys anymore.
That's right. You want to stay on their good side. Well, Adam Jude, was working that night, and he found the Seattle Times story on the last, the original Turn Ahead the Clock game, which was 20 years earlier in 1998, and found a picture of me that was in that sports section.
Gosh.
So he put that on Twitter, blown up, so that I looked horrible. And it's kind of sobering that it's been 20 years and I was there for the last one as well.
Well, you know, it's not that bad, Stoney. You're not that. Oh my goodness, you have a lot of hair.
Yeah, that was the first thing that struck me too, is how bald I've become, which is very depressing. But
sorry, man.
It'll happen to you too, you know.
No, my dad's got a full head of hair. So does my grandpa and all those things.
It's your mom's dad that you look at.
Yeah, he died with a full head of hair. I don't see a lot of bald Japanese guys.
My dad is 94 and has a full head of hair. Why couldn't I have inherited that?
I don't know. I'm sorry, man. What, you know, beyond the the uniforms. Pretty good weekend for the Mariners, you know. Sweep a bad team, a team they should sweep. They go out and do it.
Yeah, I mean, back-to-back bad teams, and I think we – I'm going to take a little digression here, and boy, those teams are bad.
Oh, yes, they are.
You know, the Rays –
Who's the worst? Who's worse?
I think the Orioles are worse because they look like they've stopped trying. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not running balls out. They're going through the motions. I don't know how Buck Showalter is going to keep his job. At least the Royals look like they're giving an effort. They're just horrible. But what's interesting is that everyone's talking about tanking, and there's a lot of these bad teams: Miami, Cincinnati, Chicago. They're bad on purpose because they're going through a rebuilding process, and they got rid of their stars, and they're sucking it up and hoping they come up out on the other side, like the Astros and the Cubs and teams that did this and won. The Phillies are now coming out on the other side, but the Orioles and the Royals, they were trying to be good this year. I mean, the Royals, yeah, they lost Lorenzo Cain and Hosmer, but they re-signed Moustakas, they re-signed Gordon. I think they thought they'd be a middle of the pack team. The Orioles, I think, thought they'd be a contender this year, and they're both headed for 110 losses. Because they're going to get even worse. Because the Orioles are going to trade Machado any week now, and they're going to trade Britton, their closer. The Royals are going to trade whatever live body someone will take. You know, Moustakas or probably who else do they got?
Yeah,
I don't
like
know. But
Lucas Duda, and they got Danny Duffy. I don't know anybody. They've already traded Herrera. So
right, yeah. So I was just discussing this with Jeff Baker was in the office, and I said they might actually get better when they do that, those two teams, because instead of having bored veterans, they'll have hungry young players at least trying to make their name and make their money. So I actually think those teams might counterintuitively get better after they trade guys like Machado and Moustakas, but they're just about as bad as it gets right now. But you know, I don't diminish those wins. You got to beat those teams, and going 7-for-7 against those two teams is the mark of a really, really good team. And those wins count just as much as the other ones at the end of the year. And they're still on 103 win pace. So I don't. Rather than minimizing those wins, I think Mariners fans ought to savor them.
Yeah, first of all, I'm really sad I missed out on that conversation in the office. Truly, truly hurting. Second of all, no, you're right. Look, if a team wins 100 games, that means they lose 62 in a season. Throughout a course of a season, you're going to drop a game. You're going to have a bad outing by a starter. You're going to do something. They won 7 games in a row. I mean, that against, yes, there are bad teams, but there's still things that could have gone wrong. And there was things that did go wrong in that. It's not like they played great in that Orioles series. You know, they didn't play exceptionally well by any means.
They were behind in just about every game. Yes. And then it was just like the bad team is going to find a way to blow this game. That's the way I felt through the entirety of those games, that the Orioles were going to find a way to lose those games. And that's exactly what happened.
The Orioles right now, they remind me of some of those Mariners teams that were just trying to hang on with Bavezzi, and you had Howard as the owner, and they didn't know how. Like, they knew they should rebuild. They didn't know how, and they would be wishy-washy about it. They should have traded Manny Machado a month ago. That's one less prospect probably you lost, because a team is willing to pay for that month. You know, an extra month of Machado means more that you can give up. They should have traded him a month ago. His value would be even higher, because now he just looks like, you know, kind of a guy playing out the string till he gets traded. I mean, you might think of Randy Johnson back in the old days. And Britton was hurt, but he needs to go. You know, they should – anybody that they can get rid of, they should. Oh, my God.
Adam Jones, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know how much value he has. I mean, when you're batting Danny Valencia 5 and he looks like he's one of the harder-playing players, you're in trouble. You're in trouble.
This is the perfect team for a Danny Valencia. This is, he'll put up great stats.
Yeah.
In a team going nowhere. And
believe me, there was some grumblings when he hit those home runs off of guys that are like, I mean, all the people that they could give a home run to, Danny Valencia. They were just like, oh. I thought it was overall, I mean, they're playing well. We'll see. They got the Angels coming in. The Angels are pretty wounded. Mike Trout's still going to hit about 750 in the series. I'm certain of it. So, at what point do you challenge Mike Trout, and what point don't you?
Well,
anytime probably. A runner on, do you put him on base?
You know, he's actually in a little bit of a slump right now.
Oh, I'm sure that he can find a slump buster here.
Yeah, he probably will, but I think he's only had one extra base hit in like the last week. He just finished. He had the longest stretch without an extra base hit in his career, and then he hit a home run two games ago, and then I think he had an 0 for the next game. You know, he's still getting on base, walking twice a game, but I wouldn't challenge him at all with a runner on base. I don't think, because they don't have much else in that lineup. I guess Ohtani's going to come back, right? I haven't really. Yeah, seen the latest on that.
But there's a lot of Japanese media here in the press box, so yeah, it's probably.
So that's he's a threat. Andrelton Simmons and Upton, they've got some threats, but you know, he owns this team, and I think the prudent thing is to not intentionally walk him, but to pitch him exceedingly careful.
That exceedingly careful is good if you can command, but I don't know if these guys, that's kind of the problem, but we'll see. I'm curious about that. Who had a better outing, Marco or James Paxton? Also, what the hell? I go out of town for three games, and all those games are sub-230. What a bunch of crap.
That means tonight will be 4.5.
Oh, yeah. I'm 14 innings. Plus fireworks for sure. Tonight. Fireworks. I'm going to be riding with explosions and patriotic music.
There's nothing worse than that. Plus, that delays the fans leaving, so that you get in the traffic jam afterwards too.
Listen to us whine.
I think probably Paxton. Probably Marco. I would rate for importance for him to get over that barrier of a complete game, and I think Paxton's game was more dominating, but he's a more dominating style pitching. I mean, they were both great, both just what they needed. Marco's developing into a real frontline pitcher, and if he regularly starts going 7-8 innings, although I think one thing we should discuss is how they're going to. They've got two guys that they've got to really worry about innings wise, Marco and Edwin Diaz, and how are they going to temper those innings down the stretch? I mean, you can't have Edwin Diaz leading the major leagues, at least the American League, in appearances and on pace for close to 80, that you just don't want that from your closer. And his numbers are great, but I think you've got to be careful about maybe holding him back a little in the second half. And same with Marco. You've got to limit his innings a little. And I know they have planned for that, and maybe go to a six-man rotation or holding those guys out of a start or two. Paxton as well, just to keep them fresh for the long haul.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll do a 5.5-man rotation where they bump in a guy every so often to give a guy extra day Marco, the most he has thrown in a season was 2014. He threw 122 innings. That's pre-Tommy John. He's at 103rd right now. So, yeah, they have to monitor that, the Verducci rule of, 20 or 40 plus what you threw the year before or whatever. And this is a guy that's, Tommy John removed 2 years from now ago. So they do have to monitor that. Diaz, you're right, as well. Hell, even Wade LeBlanc. I mean, as old as he hadn't been stretched out to a full-length starter season in a while either.
You know, it just goes to show how stupid the Nationals were a couple of years ago, with Strasburg. Mm-hmm. They couldn't come up with a better plan than just pitching him all the way through until he reached his innings limit and then shutting him down for the postseason. Why they didn't spread out sprinkle in missed outings and stuff so they'd have them for the postseason. I think the Mariners and other teams have learned from that there's better ways to limit the innings of these guys over time so that you have them for the postseason rather than just pitching them nonstop until they're done and then say, I'll see you next year. I mean, can you imagine if the Mariners did that with Marco? I mean,
That'd be crazy. It would not be good. I mean, he really has exceeded all of our expectations in that. Paxton, that start yesterday, that pretty much solidified him on the All-Star team, you think?
Yeah, I got to think Diaz and Paxton are locks. And then Segura, Haniger, and Cruz are maybes.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it. I think Segura is just cementing his place. I mean, I don't know. I used to think that it was going to be a long shot, but when you're hitting 340, I don't know how you can keep that guy off the team. I guess he's down to 335 now, but right. hovering between 330 and 340. And then Haniger, I think Haniger might end up being the odd man out on the one that's maybe a little unfair because he's second in the league in RBIs and stuff. But there's just it's hard to break in there when there's so every team has to have a guy. You got the player vote, you got the fan vote. There's not much room for discretion from the manager.
Yeah, and there's gonna. I honestly think Segura might be in that, you know, that last player vote, which will be a huge pain in the rear. But I think that's what's gonna happen.
You know, the Mariners have never had.
In the
last fan vote, which is amazing to me. I think they're the only team. It's been going on for quite a number of years. Yeah, I think Segura. If they're not on the team, Segura and Haniger are obvious candidates for that. And that's the sort of thing where. The two guys we were mentioning earlier, Green and Martinez, the marketing guys, that'd be right in their wheelhouse for a organized campaign to get the fan vote out for those guys.
You're going to the All-Star game this year.
I am.
Yes. How many All-Star games have you covered?
Well, I'll go back and count, but it's got to be 15, 16. First one was I actually attended one as a fan at Dodger Stadium long before I became I was still in college with a friend. So that was I don't count that one, but the first one I did was in Oakland when I was working in Oakland. And I did almost every one up until when you came on the beat, I did almost every one from then on. So I mean, it might be closer to 20.
So in your honest opinion, how physically taxing is it on a player to go to the All-Star game, especially when they do not participate in the Home Run Derby?
Not very.
Okay.
I don't think. I think that whatever that taxing is more than made up with by the thrill they feel for being there, particularly the first-timers. I mean, you've seen guys like Kyle Seager and first-time All-Stars. They soak it all up. I know Edwin Diaz will this year, and Paxton as well. So I don't think they feel much stress at all. But, you know, pitchers used to go three innings. Now you're lucky if you get one guy to go two. Starting pitchers used to start and go three innings routinely, but I don't think everyone's more mindful of limiting the pitches now than they ever were. So it could be a little bit of a stress on a pitcher.
But essentially, it's like a throw day on a 7-day break. You know what I
right.
mean? So it's not because like last year, I believe Diaz said he threw twice on the All-Star break because you know he didn't like how he felt if he didn't throw consistently. I think he threw a bullpen and played catch the other time.
Yeah,
I was having this argument with people on Twitter, not necessarily argument, but some people were like, well, you know, I hope they don't make it because I'd rather have them rest. And then somebody was like, well, I don't want them flying across the country. One, they charter a jet. Okay. They don't, they're not flying like Larry's going to be flying middle seat out of Seattle on an Alaska flight.
Through Chicago.
Oh yeah. Good one. Nice job there, buddy. Yeah. They're not flying commercial. And if they are, they're flying first class. And most of the time
they're going from Colorado too.
Yeah, they're going from Colorado, and a lot of times what they do is they all just chip in together and they charter a jet. And sometimes the Mariners, I think, even use the corporate plane to fly them to the All-Star game and get them back.
A lot of times they'll go with the team that they're playing. They'll team up.
Yeah,
and they'll go jet. Together.
So it's not a real difficult flight there. And then as I pointed out. The players, for the most part, they especially when you end on the road, I think it's even more so when you're ending at the break on the road. A lot of the players don't go back to Seattle and just sit there and relax and like lay in a hyperbaric chamber to recover. A lot of them go back home to Miami, to Florida, wherever they at. Or I know Diaz went to Puerto Rico one year. I mean, that's not a short flight. They go home and you never know what they're doing. I mean, I think this whole idea that this somehow hinders them in their second half production. Is ludicrous. And, you know, and people don't realize, I think, being around the players, what an honor it is for them to go and be there amongst the best of the best, their peers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't think you lose that even if you're a 10-time All-Star. You know, Felix has been in a lot of All-Star games. I bet he would be just as thrilled to go. You know, he may never go again, but you know, I think that, I don't think that ever leaves, probably, even for a guy who's, you know, a 20-time guy like Hank Aaron or whatever. Maybe then it gets a little monotonous, but not many people get that opportunity. Now, on the other hand, the home run derby, I do think there is something to, yeah. I mean, you look at Aaron Judge last year in his first half versus his second half, and maybe it's just coincidence, maybe he hit the rookie wall or whatever, but I've just seen too many cases of guys whose swing was messed up by the home run derby, at least maybe temporarily, maybe long term, to think that there might actually be something to that.
Yeah, I do think there is that, especially guys that stay in it a long time. Like a couple of years ago in San Diego when Cano hit like two home runs and was out in the first round. I don't know if that had that much to do with it. I was looking because I was, you know, debating on Twitter, and I went through and like before and after. A lot of, if you're good enough to get there, unless, you know, remember Brian LaHare, he made it that one year with the Cubs and then he fell off. But like Cruz, the last two times he played in the All-Star game, had higher OPS in the second half than he did in the first half. You know, more home runs. So it was and I mean, like I said, these guys go to the All-Star game and they get excessively pampered. I mean, they're staying in the best hotel. They get, you know, they go there. Some of them guys get treatment, you know, whatever. They hang out. The coolest thing, honestly, I think, is the workout that they have during the day. You stand on the field and you're watching all the stars just like talking with each other, you know, or you're in the clubhouse and they're BS. Oh, let's go hit. You know, I remember the one year Trout and Seager were like, hey, let's go hit together, you know, stuff like that. It was so cool just to see that many stars interacting and talking about baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's also the most humbling moment in sports writing, which is you're hanging out on the field during batting practice, doing some interviews and watching. And then right before they're going to start the home run derby, they announce the media, please clear the field. Media, please clear the field. And there's a standing ovation from the crowd every time as they leave.
So you're
trudging off and people are cheering your removal. That's always a moment I cherish.
I've never really been down there for that. I actually, you know, one of my favorite things to do is, it's pretty fun, is covering the Futures game as well. And because you get access to some prospects and you're down there, you can watch them take batting practice. I watched Joey Gallo take batting practice in Minneapolis. It was the most terrifying thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I think I'm almost positive Felix was in the Futures game, right?
Yeah,
I covered Felix when he was in the Futures game. I covered, you know, some guys like that.
Taiwan, didn't you cover Taiwan in the Futures game?
I did, yeah. I remember one year I wrote about Billy Hamilton because he had stolen, he was on his way to stealing like 150 bases or something like that before we found out he couldn't hit. But yeah, at the time he was a huge deal. I remember seeing Prince Fielder in the Futures game and Ricky Weeks, I think. But just you get to see the future stars. And there's a pretty good record of superstars. Future superstars who have been in that Futures game. So I'm going to be covering that this year, and I'm hoping Kyle Lewis is in it because I'd love to talk to him and see him and do that story. You know, I think there's a decent chance now that seems to be playing on a regular basis and mostly healthy.
I watched Ronald Acuna last year and Ozzy Albies and Vlad Guerrero Jr. Last year was crazy how many good players there were at that. It was unreal.
Yeah, that was a good run of prospects. What's the story with Vlad Guerrero Jr.? I know he's out with an injury. He's a guy I would have loved to have seen this year.
I'm not certain what's going on with him. Speaking of prospects, Sam Carlson, the Mariners' top pitching prospect, underwent Tommy John surgery yesterday. He's had elbow issues. He had elbow issues when we were down there in spring training. Should they have just cut on him then? Or should they have tried this thing that they did? Because this, you know, is what the same thing they did with Smiley and a couple other guys.
The difference being that this guy is, what, 19 years old? Yeah. I mean, he was signed out of high school, so he's got his whole career ahead of him. I don't think a couple of months makes any difference in the big picture. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to rehab it the other way. He still has time plenty of time to reestablish his career. And those 2 months aren't going to, 3 months aren't going to make that much of a difference. He's going to be out a long time, and either way, probably next year is shot either way. So maybe if he can come back by the end of the year and then go into 2020 healed. But it's a setback. Yeah, there's no guarantee guys are going to come back from Tommy John. A lot of guys do, a lot far more than shoulder surgery. Just ask Iwakuma, who keeps getting shut down.
Yeah.
Not everybody does. And so this is a prize. This is one of their prize prospects. So you don't like to see those guys go under the knife. But I don't think it's a career ender or anything like that.
No, definitely feel bad for the kid, though. I met the kid in Minneapolis, and he was pretty touted. They thought they got a steal with him and getting him in the second round that year, and they were very creative with their money to make sure they signed him, and it didn't work out. But this isn't a death sentence for your career the way it used to be. Guys come back from it. Sometimes they come back stronger, so it'll be interesting to see. It's going to take a while. You can't really expect him to be much more than 2020. And even then, when he does come back in 2020, I mean, he's pitched in two professional games, both at the Arizona Rookie League level, so he's going to have to go up the scale a little bit. But, pitchers can move fast if they get advanced, and so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, Marco Gonzalez is a classic example of a guy who comes back from Tommy John surgery and is doing just as well, if not better. But he struggled last year in his first year back. I think he wasn't anywhere near the pitcher he is now. So it is a process, and you have to be patient with it. But fortunately, he'll be going through that process at Single A rather than in the major leagues.
Larry, do you feel like defensive shifts are discriminatory against left-handed hitters?
Well, I was a left-handed hitter once, way back when. I'm a lefty.
Takes away from your unfair advantage of everybody being right-handed.
Yeah, there's a lot of built-in advantages to being left. I think that's a little. You're referring to Scott Boras's comment.
Yes, Scott Boras.
But I don't like defensive shifts. I understand them. And if I were running a team, I'd use them. But I just don't like a ball that's been a base hit for all of the time immemorial in baseball. Suddenly there's a guy standing in short right field who throws you out from a mile away. Or there's you hit a everyone says, going way back in baseball, hit the ball up the middle. That's how you get your stroke back. So you hit a shot up the middle, and there's a guy standing behind second base to throw you out. I think it's harming the game. I honestly do. I think all this talk about the lack of offense and the lack of runs and the lack of action, I think a lot of it is attributable to this huge increase in shifts, and teams have every right to use them. But I don't like them.
You've been hanging out with Seager and smoke too much. That's the problem. They've got in your head.
Well, Seager or smoke kind of broke through that and has become a very productive player. All-star last year and having a decent year this year as well. I do think that it's in Seager's head a little bit, or it's certainly marred his offense. I think he's a victim of those shifts as much as anybody.
What do you think is more important for the Mariners now? A reliever, a right-handed reliever who could possibly pitch the eighth inning, or another starter?
I think a right-handed reliever. I don't see a dire need to get a starter. Maybe I'm showing too much faith in Wade LeBlanc.
Possibly.
But, you get to the postseason, you only need a four-man rotation anyway, and you are going, barring a major collapse, going to get to the postseason. So, what they're looking at is a pursuit of catching the Astros or passing the Red Sox or Yankees for the first wild card and assuring themselves at least of a home wild card game. I think both are kind of long shots. I certainly wouldn't give up Kyle Lewis in the pursuit of that. And then, you know, if you can get somebody, but what if you give up a prospect and then you're in the one game playoff at Fenway and you run into Chris Sale and you lose 3-1 and you're done and you've given up this prospect for a run at a postseason that doesn't get any farther than that. So, but on the other hand, I think an eighth inning guy, lockdown guy would be extremely, extremely valuable.
Well, they thought they've had two of them and they
don't. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I was listening on the radio today and somebody was talking about Nicasio's numbers, which are better than his performance. He's got like a 35 to 3, or let me look at him here. Let's have a musical interlude here while I look up. His strikeouts to walks ratio is very encouraging. He's got 41 strikeouts and 3 walks. You know, that'll fly. So maybe he's been pitching in some bad luck. On the other hand, he's given up 40 hits in 33 innings and 4 homers. But 41 to 3 is as good, you know, as good as it gets almost. And so maybe he's going to have a good second half.
They probably need to get another guy, though. I just don't see why they can't get another guy. Just because. I mean, you have to trust some other guys. So.
Okay, yeah, it's someone like a Zach Britton.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what it would take to get him, but suddenly you'd have a third ex-closer kind of guy to hope he's the one that bridges the gap. I mean, if you get all those guys at optimal, if you get Colome, Nicasio, and player X all clicking and in front of Diaz, suddenly you really got something.
There's a guy that Kyle Barraclough, I think his name is,
from the
Marlins. He's okay. I mean, he might be available. There's some right-handed guys, but just more depth, I think, wouldn't be a bad thing. If they could get a starter as well, get a starter. If you could buy the contract of Jay Happ or something, or somebody like that, and add him in. I know you're not a huge Jay Happ fan, but, you know, something like that. Because I just don't know if the magic of Wade LeBlanc is going to last forever. Answer me this. We'll get out of here on this because, you know, you got to go and. So who is more of a threat right now? Who is the biggest threat to catch the Mariners for the second wild card? If you believe, and let's point out, the Mariners are half game behind the Astros right now in the AL West standings. They're half game out. I was just looking. Mariners are 54-31, half game behind the Astros, and they've got a few more losses. They have the same amount of wins as the Yankees, but a few more losses. So. I mean, they're still there. I don't know if it's sustainable. I mean, they can't keep playing the Royals and the Orioles all the time. But who is a bigger threat? Who is the threat to possibly give the Mariners trouble in the second half of the season?
I think Oakland. I mean, are you talking about from behind?
Catching them from behind, yeah.
I mean, they're now 11 games ahead of the Angels. If they win two out of three. No, I don't think so. Just 11.
I'm looking at Baseball Reference, but they might not update their standings.
Well, I'm looking at the Seattle Times.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and I know they updated their standings. So the Mariners are a half game behind, and the Angels are 11.5 behind the Astros. So if you take 11.5 and subtract the half.
My bad. I was looking at the other one. Yeah, my bad. So my math is bad.
So if they win 2 out of 3, you pick up a game, suddenly they're 12 behind you. I mean, the Mariners made up 12 games on the Angels in less time in 1995, but that's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and they had Ken Griffey Jr. Well, the Angels have Mike Trout, but they don't have Randy Johnson.
Yeah.
So I think you could bury the Angels right now. And Oakland's, you know, Oakland's a young, talented team. I don't think they're going to make up the 8 games, but... I think they're going to be pesky. I think they're going to be a pesky little team that just doesn't ever go away. And so, I mean, between those, the Angels just have too many injuries, and just they're basically Mike Trout and the 24 dwarfs. So,
what's amazing is, I mean, there's nobody else with a winning record. In the National League.
No.
It's
American League, yeah.
American League. I mean, Detroit is second in the Central at 38-48.
Yeah, I know. Well, Tampa has now moved to 500 after sweeping the Astros. Who saw that coming? Yeah. I mean, Tampa's gotten better since they traded Colomay and Span. No. I mean,
that's, also the other day, Brad Miller won a game on a walk-off walk. I didn't think that was humanly possible from Brad Miller.
He's also playing shortstop again. Did you notice that?
Yeah, that's scary.
He's also hitting over 400 since he joined the Brewers. Just a small sample size, but
and meanwhile. Nick Franklin is back in AAA again with Brad Miller playing ahead of him. It's just like you can't get away from the guy.
No, I know. I'm happy for Brad. He's one of my favorite guys. So
he's hit down to 345. 345 with two doubles, a homer, six RBIs in nine games.
Yeah, he's hitting 270 overall. But
yeah, for the Brewers.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Let's see where has he made any errors at shortstop. He's played five games at shortstop. And made two errors already.
Probably throwing errors.
You never know. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up this week, and then we'll do a what is your schedule next week?
I'm going home to a quick trip to California to see my my parents, and then I will be back on Monday.
Okay. So we'll do something next at the end of this week. So, all right, man. Thanks for coming on.
Okay. My pleasure.
Okay, that will do it for this week's episode of the Extra Innings Podcast. Big thanks to Larry Stone for coming on, as always, taking some time out of his day, interrupting his column writing to discuss a little baseball. As I said again, thanks to all those people that allowed me that time off. We don't get time off during the season too often, so you always cherish it when you can. And to take 3 days off, 4 days off in a row is something that's really special, so I really appreciate that. Thanks, as always, to Midnight Salvage Company, the official house band of the Extra Innings Podcast, for all the music on the lead-ins and bumpers. And if you need to get a hold of me, you can email me at rdivish@seattletimes.com, hit me up on Twitter at Ryan Divish, or on Facebook. We will do this again soon. Thanks for listening.